Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Welcome to the new year, folks. It's 2018, and we are marching into our eighth year of podcasting. We have almost 365 unique episodes in our archive. We'll hit that benchmark in about a month. That's one podcast for every day of the year. And for all your new listeners, I want to thank you for tuning in. And for you old listeners, thank you for sticking with us throughout the years. We have a lot of interesting things planned for the coming year. So please tell a friend, because we would enjoy the company. My guest today is Dr. Dillard Ferris, an emeritus professor of physics at Wheaton College, where he began teaching in 1969 after earning a doctorate at the University of California, Berkeley, and his undergraduate degree at Rice University in Houston. He specializes in nonlinear optics, the physics of music, and quantum physics, and is the recent author of the book Amazing Grace of Quantum Physics, out from Pickwick Publishers. We will link to that book on our website if you're interested in physics like I am. It's a really fascinating and challenging read. However, you may best know Professor Ferris because he is the U.S. patent holder of the device for simultaneously Q-switching several independent Ruby lasers. And I have to admit, that is one of my favorite Ruby laser patents. I don't have many others, but if that's the one, that's the one I go with. Dillard, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you.
What, can I just ask right off the bat, what is a ruby laser?
Ruby laser, rubies are the well-known gem, a red gem. And the earliest lasers, there were two different early lasers. One was ruby lasers, and so it's just a oversized gem through which light is amplified because of the pumping, which is done by a big flash lamp. So it was one of the earliest lasers.
That's very cool. It must have been fun to invent and play around with those kind of things. A beautiful color, rubies, too. Now, I always like to start off our discussion with a bit of biographical information about my guest and try to determine how they ended up writing what they did. Your background is very, very interesting. You, one, have a PhD in physics, two, attended UC Berkeley for graduate work, three, attended Berkeley in the 1960s, and four, you are now writing about the spiritual nature of quantum physics. If we were playing that Sesame Street game, one of these things does not go with the others. That whole Christian thing seems to be a bit of a misfit there. So tell us about your background, both scientific and religious, and how did you end up in the professional trajectory that you did?
Well, I was raised in a Christian home in the South, small town America, and managed to go to Berkeley, which in those years was derided as the Little Red Schoolhouse, you may know, the communist connection. So it does perhaps seem like a misfit, but it's not perhaps as much a misfit as we think. The chairman of the physics department when I went there was the sponsor of the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, so there were Christians and in the physics department even.
Fascinating. How did you get interested in physics as a field of study?
Well, I was pretty good mathematically in high school, and the physics class was challenging, and so I took the challenge and said, I'm going to be a physics major and give it a shot, and I just never changed from that. It continued to fascinate me, and so I just kept going.
Now, after you earned your doctorate at Berkeley, you went over to Wheaton, where you taught for 4+ decades there until you retired. I'm just kind of curious, because I've been in the profession now, teaching at the University of Washington for 24 years. What changes have you witnessed over time in the students and the faculty at Wheaton or in the academy more generally?
Well, in the students, we always worried that they weren't as well prepared as we were, or earlier students. We always thought that the students didn't know as much when they came in and weren't as dedicated, as serious about their studies. On the other side, the particularly at Wheaton, the Christian side, the Wheaton when I went there was very conservative in lots of its manifestations with respect to what one could do, quite ridiculous rules sometimes, and that eased over the decades by quite a bit. And of course, people at the doctoral level, which most of the faculty are, tend to be fairly academic and much more liberal than we usually associate with conservative Christian areas. And that certainly also was true at Wheaton.
Yeah. Remind me of again, what denominational affiliation is Wheaton? Is it just general evangelical?
It is not denominational.
Okay.
It is, I guess they would call it interdenominational, because there is some wide background of people who go there, and it came from a congregational starting back in the abolitionist movement. Jonathan Blanchard was a congregational minister, and there is a church right next to the college which hasn't really kept that kind of denominational affiliation either, but is the closest thing to the fit with Wheaton College. And of course, Billy Graham is the most well-known graduate, and he also doesn't fit with a very strong denominational connection.
Yeah, I should have known that. I always associate with some sort of affiliation, but I do have a good friend there, Tracy McKenzie, who we've interviewed on the past before.
I know Tracy.
He's a great guy.
Even though he came after I retired.
Yeah. He used to be here at the University of Washington, and we miss him so sorely. So, but your new book. Let's turn to that for a moment. The new book is called Amazing Grace of Quantum Physics, and it is an interesting walk not only through physics, but the history of physics for the past century or so. And then along the way of this walk, you throw in some theological reflections that are pretty important. What motivated you to write that book?
Well, when I first started teaching, I guess maybe even going back before that, quantum mechanics was a great challenge in the world of physics. When I first studied it, there was certainly no mystery associated with it in terms of the way it was taught. Everybody acted like we knew everything, and you've just got to learn the rules, and this is the way it is. But I soon realized that not only was it difficult, but it was had some very mysterious connections to it. And so from my earliest teachings, I felt like that we should let other people besides physics majors know something about quantum mechanics. So I started a course called Ideas of Quantum Mechanics for Non-Science People, and taught that a number of times through the years.
That sounds like a class that I would be really interested in. I like to dabble a little bit in quantum physics. I'm a big fan of John Gribben's books. It kind of explains all this stuff for the lay individual, and it just does seem such like a strange world that foreign to us, but if you start to think about some of the philosophers and theologians throughout time, it's like, some of those ideas are kind of embedded in there as well. And that's what we want to talk about here. Your book opens with a discourse on sin and choice, which is an interesting way to start a book that has physics in the title. And you make an interesting statement right at the outset. And I'm going to quote this here. You say, "Chance is nature's free will, choice is mankind's free will, and grace is God's free will," unquote. What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess that chance is the most obvious new idea that quantum physics brought to us, and I always ran across this question of chance in terms of God, and so this is my attempt to put these all together, the idea that God, in making the world, made it with something of his own character in it, and if he had the ability, the freedom to do what he wanted to, that he would naturally make mankind to have freedom, perhaps in a more limited way, and that also what we call physical nature would also express this kind of opportunity for freedom, not to be determined by some very strict laws.
That's going to be one of the challenges to explain throughout here, because it doesn't fit with our notions of classical physics, or at least the way we were taught classical physics. So let's start to walk through your book now. And as I mentioned before, it's a historical walk that starts with the classical physics paradigm, or the sometimes known as the Newtonian physics paradigm. And that was the physics of the 18th and 19th centuries for the most part. Tell us what the classical physics paradigm is.
Well, it really is what we have come to consider common sense, that we have a very simple idea of reality, that there are pieces of reality which we call matter, and those move around according to very straightforward laws which can be calculated with essentially perfect accuracy. So that becomes then an almost complete picture of the universe, is that we have particles that move, and if you know where every particle moves and how every particle moves, it appears that there really isn't anything else to explain. We have it all figured out.
Now, that's the physics that were taught in junior high and high school. It's still fairly useful, it seems to me, because if you're an engineer, you just rely upon Newtonian physics to figure out how bridges are going to stay up and how, you know, planes are going to fly and all things like that. Is it still useful, and why do we tend to, you know, since quantum mechanics has either added to this or replaced some of the thinking here, why do we still tend to focus on Newtonian physics, teaching it in high school and such?
Exactly what you said. It's very useful, and in the realm that we use it in, it's very hard to say that it's wrong. I think I probably quoted in the book somewhere, Kenneth Boulding, I don't know what he would be called, something of an economic philosopher, said that the going to the moon was the crowning achievement of the 17th century. That we really don't have to know anything more than classical physics to do these tremendous space explorations, and so it is a very practical everyday world that we live in. It is dominated by classical physics, and not incorrectly.
That's good to know, because I know I did pretty well in classical physics in high school, and if they had introduced quantum physics to me at that time, I think I would have just dropped out of school. It would have been too strange for me. But it's interesting that this Newtonian paradigm through this 18th and 19th century comes about at a time of religious change and religious thinking as well, especially the 19th century. What are the effects of the classical paradigm on our religious and spiritual thinking?
Well, it's hard to put those together because some people would say that religious thinking of going back certainly to the 16th century would have set the stage or perhaps even caused the what we call the rise of modern science, the Newtonian paradigm. And so it's very hard to sort out which came first and how those two are interconnected. But definitely with this, with the idea that all of the matter in the universe is something that we can get a handle on, we can touch, we can see, and that we can follow it perfectly is an idea that naturally results in a disappearance of God. God may have started that. He may have provided the laws for it, but he's certainly not necessary for being involved in it. And I think that that's certainly lost the most important idea of Christianity, and that is that God, in fact, did become incarnate. And I think that incarnational aspect goes into all aspects of nature, not in just a simple creation and a lawful nature of the world.
Interesting perspective here. I know that this Newtonian paradigm also affected economics. You mentioned Kenneth Boulding here a while ago, and I didn't expect his name to come up in a physics conversation because he is an economic historian. And it's interesting to think, too, that based on the Newtonian view of the world, all we have to do is just figure out the right variables, measure them properly, and then we can explain the past perfectly and predict the future perfectly because everything is going to bounce the way it's going to bounce. Let me ask you about the classical paradigm in relation to several tensions or paradoxes that were built into it. And this becomes more apparent when we begin to dip our toes into the world of quantum mechanics that comes onto the scene circa 1900. You kind of give a historical view of this. It comes a little bit earlier in some forms and a little bit later. So, you know, 1900 is kind of the benchmark there. If you could lay out some of the paradoxes and theological consequences of this Newtonian paradigm before we get into the world of quantum mechanics.
Well, the whole idea that comes into quantum mechanics is actually something that is very prominent already in our historical ideas of what the world is about, and that is the ideas of discontinuity. Particles are at one point, at one place in space, and they are not at other points in space, and that's a discontinuity. The world that we may be able to think of it is a world of continuity, but even from the very earliest atomic ideas in Greek philosophy, there was an idea that there was some individual fundamental particles which were separated from the rest of the world, and this whole idea then of continuity and discontinuity, which have to be somehow reconciled, produces a tension which had to eventually be somehow resolved, and it is resolved in the sense of quantum mechanics by these ideas of jumps. There was an idea that nature doesn't do jumps. I can't quote the Latin version of that, but it's a very commonly quoted Latin version that nature does not jump. It only behaves in a very continuous fashion, and quantum mechanics is the mechanics of the world when it jumps. And particle creation would be one of those kind of effects that up through the 19th century, I think, very strongly did not exist. That is, the material world was one which was existed in some kind of fundamental being that had basically an eternal existence, and that we had that to work with, and those particles did not come into being or go out of being. Basically, matter was conserved. And what we found is that new particles came into our experience, and we found that those new particles somehow were being created, and they were created in a very jumpy fashion and a very chancy, or even we might use the word random, as random events.
Another thing that you bring up, tension is between certainty and uncertainty. And this creates a later interesting paradox with Schrödinger and the Heisenberg principle. But what is this tension between certainty and uncertainty?
Well, the idea in classical physics, and I guess one of the reasons that we teach it is because it does have a very great deal of certainty. We can follow these particles exactly accurately, and that's basically the idea of calculus that Newton invented to describe the physical world of his time. And the idea that you can take the limit down to as small as you like, essentially to zero, and get complete certainty is then a big part of the classical paradigm, is that we have a certain world. And you can recognize that, of course, comes out of a very high idea of God, the omnipotent, the omniscient, all of those kind of words also speak of the same kind of certainty that we all desire naturally, but we actually live in a quite uncertain world. And the uncertainties that we experience as individuals in our lives is reflected in an uncertainty in this underworld of the world of the very small, which quantum mechanics deals with.
How about the question of determinism and indeterminism? It seems to flow from this idea of certainty and uncertainty as well.
Right. It's very hard to tell the difference between those two. In fact, if you've read anything about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which is one of the major statements of quantum mechanics, it's often sometimes even referred to as the as indeterminism instead of uncertainty, because uncertainty deals with the question of how we look at it. Question of knowledge, whereas indeterminism deals with hopefully what is really there, basically the ontology as opposed to our questions of epistemology. And so it appeared and still appears that the ideas of determinism, which flowed naturally out of the classical physics view, and maybe out of our views of God, really did not hold, that they are in fact indeterminate, that they do not exist in the way that we thought they existed, that they come about with chance or randomness.
One of the other tensions that you mentioned too was a big mind blower to me. The first ones that you discussed are pretty familiar with my own readings of these casual readings of quantum physics, but this one was a little bit more bizarre to me, and that's the notion of reality, a reality, that's a dash reality, and then anti-reality. What is that all about?
Well, classically, we've felt that we knew what reality is. As Dr. Johnson said, the reality is kickability. I can kick it. I know it's real. In quantum mechanics, we come to the point where we don't know that the material world has that kind of reality, and it appears that the reality that occurs in quantum mechanics comes about basically only when we ask realistic questions of it. So it becomes to the question of the object's subject paradox that the object is not just sitting out there waiting to be discovered or kicked or checked in its reality. It is a reality of potentiality that will in fact do something when we ask it of it, but until we ask of it, it actually has at least a completely uncertain reality to us, and we really cannot attribute reality to it in the same sense that we have classically used the words.
Yeah, this stuff starts to get really strange then, and I can imagine how this really starts to not only shake up our thinking about the physical world, but our philosophical and theological understandings of life as well. Let me finish up with a few more of the tensions that you have, because they do seem to be somewhat related, and if you could bundle those together for us. You talk about the importance of causality versus accident and randomness. You talk about the differences or the tensions between chance and choice, and then also causality and purpose. How are those things related to quantum mechanics versus ye olde Newtonian physics?
Well, the three major inputs into classical physics, as far as I guess we would use the word Kantian categories that Kant felt that we brought as a priori's into our view of the world were space, time, and causality. And causality in those terms became a very narrow lawful ordering of nature that we had basically the only cause that was necessary within the classical framework was that of a force, and Newton's major law, which we call the second law, was basically how does that cause, force, change the effects, or have effects in motion. And that's really all we needed with his calculus to actually calculate everything perfectly. And the result then is that that we had this machine-like causality, which managed to basically get rid of any ideas of purpose, or to use more philosophical or religious language, the ideas of eschatology in religion, or of teleology in a more philosophical terminology.
One of the last categories that fascinated me too in this tensions within classical paradigm was and quantum mechanics is the idea of being and becoming. That one was a hard one for me to wrap my head around. Explain that one.
Well, of course, this goes back to actually the pre-Socratic philosophers, that there was a big tension in the world of what is the reality, with one side thinking that the ideas of being, the fundamental pieces of nature, existing in this sort of static way, were the fundamental things, and others saying that the only important idea is change, that how things become, move, and in when we get to the ideas of quantum mechanics, the whole idea of being becomes a very squishy topic, because being, as we have described it, as the material world being a basically a given, maybe even a given to God, maybe that's what God started with, if we're thinking in terms of the creation, if that is the important thing, then the becoming or the moving around that occurs in classical physics is a trivial one. It's just a simple motion which really would have no meaning. And so the idea that we naturally associate with time, that is, that things do change and they go towards something, which again brings us back to the questions of purpose, can easily get lost. That becoming is just a trivial thing of movement, and when particles move, that's the only becoming that you get. But quantum mechanics, by basically requiring a measurement, an observer actually asking questions of nature, and having that produce the jump from this very fuzzy being, which we don't know anything about, to actually becoming something, actually gives what we might call a historical time. That historical time really became trivial, abstracted into a scientific time, which basically had no meaning except a coordinate axis in our abstract mathematical descriptions. So the idea of becoming fits very well with quantum physics.
That's really interesting, because as I was listening to you discuss some of this, I can see one pathway where dipping into quantum mechanics could become very nihilistic. You just, you know, it's all random chance. Just things pop up and jump all over the place. But what you just said a moment ago, that, you know, asking a question actively produces this kind of jump. It kind of, is that one of the big doors that opens the scientist's mind to the possibility of God and God's work in the world?
I really couldn't attest to that anyway. I don't really think that scientists are coming to those kind of realizations of God through quantum mechanics. I guess what I'm doing is trying to help them come that way by seeing that as some reflection of the way God made the universe.
Yeah, it does seem interesting. Let's now walk through the book. As I mentioned, it's a historical read. It has lots of fun characters that we might know, Einstein and Niels Bohr and a few others, but it also has a number of characters that we might not be all that familiar with. And you start out this historical walk in about the turn of the 20th century, a little bit earlier, late 1800s, with the discovery of X-rays. How does the discovery of X-rays shake up the classical paradigm and get us moving into the science of the 20th century? And then also, what kind of religious reflections does this all have? How is this shaking up our theological thinking of the world?
Well, I think that one of the important things clearly is the question of chance. I actually was in the last few days trying to look up some of these early researchers, like Rutherford's Nobel lectures, and seeing if they thought of this in terms of chance, because we do have experienced chance, obviously, in the whole history of mankind, but we often have not tried very seriously to understand it or characterize it, and I found that the closest word they used, I think, to chance was spontaneous. These X-rays and other radioactive particles occurred in a spontaneous fashion, and they were not terribly concerned about any meaning to this question of chance, but it was just as though sort of underneath, hidden in all of the nature that we thought we could understand so well by almost completing a classical physics picture, that down underneath this there was in fact a huge amount of energy involved in these particles, and that they acted in a spontaneous fashion, that is, a fashion which we could not understand. And I guess that goes back to your earlier question about the beginning of my book, where I say that chance is nature's free will. It's very, very hard for a physicist to characterize a particle as having free will, and I quite understand that. But when we don't understand at all what's going on, we don't have any better characterizations of it than to call it chance or randomness or spontaneity.
The chapter that you talk about, the X-rays, is called Seeing Beyond Seeing. And is this our first glimpse at this? You've used the term underworld here a few times, that we see the Newtonian world fairly easily, but then we start to look below, and the X-rays are kind of also are metaphorical, it seems, because you're seeing underneath the skin to the bones and things that you hadn't expected to see. So what was the purpose of that title of that chapter?
Basically, that even though externally we see a world that is at least fairly easy to characterize, and by saying, okay, here is some object that I want to follow in space, and this is how these things are made up, and I can build all kinds of things, but that down inside, that is something that we had hints or suggestions of all the way back to, again, pre-Socratic philosophy, that there are some kind of fundamental particles that are underneath there that we do not see. This is really the first time that we started to be able to see some of these individual events or even particles. It's perhaps hard for us to imagine that as atomism has been around philosophically for at least 2,500 years, but it was not around in our experience, in our direct experience, until basically the 20th century, that this is the first time that we really started to know that there were these very, very small individual particles that we could not see in our macroscopic world, but that they had, in fact, very big effects and were very energetic. They are, in fact, a million times more energetic than the typical chemical interactions. So they really just shot through us with this, with very large amount of energy coming from very individual events.
One of the other things that we need to see with is light. It's easier to see things in the light than it is in the dark. And one of the next developments and debates within physics relates to the nature of light. Light is very central to religion. There are many allegorical and metaphorical references to light throughout the scriptures. Connect all these dots for us, or I should say waves or energy fields, by discussing what the theory of light brought to the table in terms of physics and what that all meant philosophically for us.
Well, good old Newton, he had a very simple idea of light, which didn't even hold up for him very well, but light was a particle, which he called a corpuscle. So we call it the corpuscular theory of light. But because he was so successful with his mechanics, his ideas dominated up to the beginning of the 19th century, when the wave picture of light suddenly became a real possibility. Even in Newton's time, a contemporary of Newton, Huygens, believed in it as a wave, but the wave nature of light, even though it explained things better than Newton's did, was still rejected until the early 19th century. And throughout the 19th century, then there was a development which made it possible for us to think that light was in fact not particulate at all, but was a wave, and the wave, as we eventually thought of it, was a wave of energy fields, of electric and magnetic fields, and by the close of the 19th century, we basically had two separate legs of classical physics, one being the particulate nature and following it by Newton's second law, and then the electromagnetic nature of the universe, where we had all of these electric and magnetic energy fields, which again had been developed within the calculus framework and therefore had perfectly good laws, and were understood to be exactly equivalent to light, which is doesn't look necessarily to be anything like some kind of invisible fields, because it is the thing which causes us to be able to see. So the main point of that whole idea then is that there is a world which we do not see or had not seen and find it difficult to see, which was in fact a very important underpinning of all of what we did see. And I see this as being the equivalent of what we're doing in religion, is that we're seeing behind the realities of our everyday life into some different realm, a different level of being that in fact has a very strong, if not totally dominant, effect in our lives.
You continue on with these thoughts in the coming chapters, and you start to toy around with the idea of reality, which explores the tension between the world of things, you know, the physical things that we see and can touch and kick, as you mentioned, and fields. And again, this starts getting really odd. This is just, you know, plays around with my mind quite a bit, even though we're not quite at the oddest point. But you write in a later chapter the following, and I thought this was a really interesting passage, and if you could explain it for us, I'd appreciate it. You write, quote, "Theologians, irked by the power, universality, precision, and total dominance of a mechanical world of matter in motion, Newton's 7th century inventions, which seemed to leave no room for the spirit or God, can obviously be sucked into the immaterial world of fields, a seemingly clear link to an omnipresent spiritual world, a world more palatable to a religious mind. These theologians, again, are being sucked into this new world of fields. But then you say, but beware the old and new temptations. What do you mean by that?
Idea that the world of spirit, a world which is somehow permeating all of reality, is much more akin to an idea of a field which is infinite in its range. A particle is something which sits there and has a boundary to it in some sense that it does not go anywhere and have any effects except on its immediate neighbors by basically touching or collisions. But the idea of a field is the influence or forces or causes which can go basically to infinity as far as we know. That is, that there is no limit to the range of these. And this is an obvious natural temptation for us to think that, you know, there is basically a spiritual world as an analogy that the omnipresent spiritual nature of God is being somehow represented by this kind of new entity which came into physics basically in the 19th century, because even though it had been toyed with in the questions of gravitation in the 17th century, Newton had been happy to just write the equation for it and not worry about any model for it or any association of a reality of anything which is reaching out and touching something at a distance. But Maxwell and Faraday in the 19th century basically then set us up for a reality of these ideas of fields, which then are a natural analogy for spirit.
And this continues on in the development of physics thought, and a number of well-known personalities come into the act, such as Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr, and your book also includes a number of not-so-well-known scholars, such as Paul Ehrenfest and Paul Dirac. I want to quantum jump, if I may, through some of this history, and then get eventually to be what becomes quantum mechanics, and really toying around with this whole notion of double reality and uncertainty. Take us up through the history of this development of thought. This leads into the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It leads us to the famous or infamous Schrödinger's cat. How does this all play into quantum mechanics and then our really theological and philosophical understanding about what is reality?
Well, as I said, there was something of a double reality in the sense that there were particles and there were fields, and the fields were able to give us an explanation of how particles were able to act on other particles without direct contact, we think of the Earth being attracted to the Sun and the Moon being attracted to the Earth and so on, basically the universal laws of gravitation, which were mirrored in the electromagnetic fields of the 19th century. And these two realities turned out to somehow be one double reality in each of the cases, where we have what we thought were particles. The material particles act like waves of some kind of fields, and the fields with their wave act like particles. And then in order to get between one and the other, we basically have to have these ideas of jumps, of creation or somehow bringing into actuality the potentials of being. And the fact that particles and waves were in fact really somehow a double reality, a complementary picture of the same thing, resulted in an uncertainty principle, which Heisenberg was able to enunciate, that the whole fuzziness of the wave picture manages to make the world of particles, which is really connected to it, an uncertain world that you cannot, in fact, talk meaningfully of both a perfectly accurate position and perfectly accurate velocities of a particle. They cannot happen simultaneously in that way in terms of our knowledge. That's saying it in terms of uncertainty principle when we say it in terms of our knowledge, but we therefore doubt its ontology, that is, that it really cannot exist in these ways, or we cannot meaningfully talk of its existence as being perfectly accurate. So that's the basic jump into quantum mechanics, is the world has these dual natures which affect one another in that kind of way.
Now let me ask you a somewhat of a personal question that explores the theological meanings of all this stuff. You mentioned your early background. You grew up as a Christian. You've been teaching at Wheaton for a while as well. When you first encountered these quantum mechanic ideas and had to wrestle with them, what was going on in your mind? Did you say, whoa, this completely confirms my Christian faith, or was there some notion in the background saying, is God playing tricks on us? Is there really a God? What were you thinking theologically at the time when you encountered these ideas?
I don't think, I mean, we have so well managed to separate these things and so treat our physics as being something that we know, and it's just a matter of you just don't understand it. If you're having trouble with it, you've just got to learn the rules. We have done this so effectively that I don't think that there was any crossover when I first encountered quantum mechanics, or even encountered it in terms of really trying to work through it. Working through quantum mechanics was a matter of conquering the material which was put before us as gospel truth, and was never treated as having any mysterious components to it. It's just that you've got to learn these rules and live with it. So I would say that there was no really theological crossover in early thinking about this.
Well, then that leads me to my last question and the reason that you wrote this book, and that is you've been studying this as a professor for some 5 decades now, and dipping back into your graduate career, it goes into 6 decades. So if you had the chance to sit down with young Dillard back in the 1960s, who saw this was being taught the separation of physics and theology, they're in different buildings, we don't talk to one another, and you had to sit down to young Dillard and explain to him all the surprises that he would see over the course of the half century and the theological things he should be reflecting upon as he goes through these studies, what would you say?
Well, the most important thing I would say is that there's lots of mystery in the world of physics that they're not telling you about. They don't really understand physics the way we think they understand physics, and that you should be willing to step out and explore the world as a mysterious place rather than as being something that is perfectly well understood.
And as for you too, as you've gone through this, has it really reaffirmed your faith? And if so, in what way?
Well, I would say that it has never been any kind of a difficulty with my faith. I don't know whether I could say that it has reaffirmed my faith. I think that I have admitted and I actually even stated it that it is sometimes a reformulation of faith or a reformulation of God, at least for some people that I've had close contact with. The idea of chance and the idea of jumps and the ideas of possible not a reality of many of these things that we are taught is just absolutely heretical. When you put it into the context of God, and I think that it does, in some ways, perhaps help me reformulate God, but has never been a barrier or a difficulty to my faith.
Some interesting thoughts and interesting reflections. My guest today has been Dillard Ferris. Dillard, thank you for being with us on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.